Hello, this is Matt Hale bringing you another Art Monthly talk show. I've done quite a few now, too many to remember. I can't even remember sometimes whether a guest has been on once or twice or what we talked about. But today we have three guests and we'll be talking about two shows, one in Athens, but except it's a group of shows, one in Brussels, but again it's a group of spaces all showing in one museum. So it's, but we're about spaces and the difference between spaces and museums today quite a lot. And we're starting off with a feature, which is basically about curating, and it's by Andrew Hunt. But we'll speak a bit more about that. But before we go any further, my dear listener, you are going to have to listen to this. We have at Art Monthly a special offer for talk show listeners. It's a free digital subscription. In other words, listeners who subscribe to the print edition, that's the print magazine, will receive free access to the entire Art Monthly back catalogue, which does go back, by the way, to 1976. So it's 10 issues every year till 1976, which is, I can't even think how many that is. Well, I do know, because actually it's 419, because that's the number of issues that we've published, because the issue we're discussing on this programme today is number 419. Okay, and this means you can read articles featured in this and all the previous Art Monthly talk show episodes. And Andrew, hello. Andrew Hunt.
Hello.
This is an Ellen.
Hi.
Mara de Wachter. I probably said it wrong.
Not bad.
But not too bad. And Vasilios Dupas. Hello.
That's right.
Vasilios. Thank you, Vasilios. Hi. Okay. And basically, everyone here has written a piece in Art Monthly's current issue, the September issue, 2018. And as I say, we're going to start with Andrew's feature, which is called Bi-Monthly Curatorship. And it's got a lot of examples. It's quite complicated in terms of its number of examples to back up its, I suppose the word thesis, but it seems a bit academic to say that, doesn't it? But you do work in a university, so you're a professor, aren't you, Andrew?
I am, unfortunately, yeah.
Where are you now, Professor?
I'm at Manchester School of Art, which is in Manchester Metropolitan University. Amazing place. I've only been there less than a year, but it's, you know, it's a really good job. I'm really enjoying it. And
yeah,
the students are great, the staff are great, institution's great. Yeah.
What do you actually, what professor of what?
Fine art and curating.
Okay, so the subject of your feature does rather fit with your position.
Yeah, it's my subject, I guess, yeah.
Because you have been a curator for many years prior to this.
Yeah, I mean, I worked for various small to medium-sized Arts Council-funded organisations.
All in the UK?
Yeah, SpaceX, Focal Point Gallery, International Project Space, Norwich Gallery in East, and I set up Redden International recently.
Yes.
As well. So that's all before I became a full-time academic. Yeah.
So you've got a bit of learning under your belt, as it were.
Yeah, in the field, as they say, yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, just because it sometimes helps to try, even if it's not very easy to do, can you try and sum up the thread that goes through your feature in Art Monthly?
Yeah, so what I was interested in was a certain strand in contemporary or recent news about curators and gallery directors and museum directors either resigning or losing their jobs. It didn't seem to be a coincidence to me that this was all happening and people were kind of finding the industry, so to speak, precarious in large institutions. So I coincidence or not, I decided that it might be interesting to look at two anniversaries: the 50th anniversary of When Attitudes Become Form, which is next year, and the 50th anniversary of the Situationist International-inspired May 68 riots.
So Harold Zeman's landmark exhibition is the When Attitudes Become Form, which I'm sure a lot of people would have heard of. But
yeah, and so there are there's kind of been, for the last few years, anniversary exhibitions and celebrations about the 50th anniversary of that seminal curatorial moment in curatorial history. And so there's a lot of kind of celebration around that, which is uncritical. So I decided to look at the idea of experimental curatorial directors at that moment, when there was seemed to be the birth of a particular form of experimentation, and what's happening now, and to say, is it actually possible in the conditions that we live to be experimental, which Kunsthalle Bern, their exhibition was claiming that, you know, this was a time for celebration, when in fact if you delve into the kind of the identity of the curatorial model that Zeman represented, there are narcissistic authorship problems, which are deeply complex. If you read kind of the idea of this kind of sacrificial author as kind of almost like a kind of communist model, communal model for a kind of identity, which is a kind of moral position. It's actually not that. It's deeply authorial, and that's been masked in a way. And I think that one of the things that's interesting is that also the problem with Zeman is that he was deeply unoriginal. So in many respects, he was highly original in some respects, but he took a lot of his ideas from dealers such as Conrad Fischer, especially around conceptual art. So then I started to think, well, what are the contemporary or more recent examples of this small version of the big institution, and they all mostly come from small radical commercial dealers such as Colin Deland, who was operating in the 80s and 90s. And you can look at a direct line from Deland and Pat Hearn, Anne Hudson, who was celebrated in New York Freeze strangely, to kind of what, you know, certain galleries like Rena Spalling's. But what I found, what I didn't mention in the article, was that there's a kind of situation in London where Deland, Pat Hearn, Conrad Fischer, they all had sort of a community of artists around them and that was really important. There was a kind of scene going on that was exciting. And for me, this might sound too negative, but there's nothing like that in London anymore. I guess Cabinet was doing it in the early 90s up until maybe 10 years ago, but that seems to have fallen away. There seems to be a gap in the market in London, whereas in New York, you've still got Rena Spalling's and Bridget Donahue and small community organisations like White Columns who are doing that job. That was the kind of basic tenet of the article, and to try and organise it and ask the question, what are the potential alternative models to represent a community in, you know, London, New York, and lots of other places.
Do either of you wish to ask him a question? It's not a problem if you don't. I was going to ask him really to expand a bit more on what you mean by experimentation, really, because it's like you've got these opposite things, but you're suggesting that there's no experimentation, isn't really something that can be done within the big institutional museum context. But what exactly, to say in terms of what we see as art when we experience this, an experimental approach, whether it be what you say is shown at White Columns, for instance, what's the difference? Is it the difference between, is the art actually different, or is it more the experience of the artists and the people visiting that's different?
Well, it's two things.
I mean,
I guess they are,
but
yeah. I mean, so I guess I'm talking about a grassroots organisation. So but there's also aesthetics that come into it. But if you look at kind of, ironically, this is a kind of contradiction, which is quite an interesting one, is that, you know, the small commercial galleries alongside artist-run spaces are similar, because in certain really interesting kind of examples, they've become a location or a kind of focal point for a community that has been able to change the way that art is made and distributed. And also small commercial galleries are usually the first organisations to be able to promote artists and get them a profile before they're either taken on by larger commercial galleries or big institutions and curators. So, but the thing is that the idea of a grassroots seeing the commercial gallery in the art, alongside the artist-run space, as a grassroots organisation is important, because grassroots, you know, the two big things in the 20th century, 21st century, like civil rights, black rights, and women's rights, wouldn't have happened without grassroots movements. So I think there's an equal situation or argument for art in increasingly precarious times, but also financially and economically and politically precarious times.
Yeah, I just wanted to come in with an idea around that, precisely that problem of London not having much of a kind of bubbling culture at the moment on a grassroots level. And I think, you know, it has a lot to do with the fact that the art industry, if we can call it an industry, which is what it is, because everything is about monetizing and funding and so on, is one of the only industries I can think of that doesn't support research and development. So if you think about pharmaceuticals, or if you think about technology, or you think about, you know, aerospace or anything like that, there are funds for young researchers and for people doing purely experimental research, which then, you know, the bigger corporations know will feed upwards into their profits. But this isn't happening in the art world. So you're getting grassroots organizations that are run by people who are running three jobs so that they can pay in from their pittance to keep the thing going. And I think that there needs to be a greater recognition that that smaller organizations are where ideas get developed and then they get sucked up and into the market by dealers.
I totally agree with that. And also, I mean, you could say the Arts Council have always, and various public funders have been able to provide artists with opportunities, financial kind of opportunities to be able to help them build their careers. And also, obviously, universities are the places that research happens. But, you know, both are under threat. So I think that, you know, there should be an acknowledgement, and actually something, you know, more, if it's possible, kind of firm put in place, especially by the larger galleries that have taken over, and usually kind of especially taken over in London, almost like banks that have come in and monopolised the culture of the city. So I think there must be a way. But, you know, having said that, would that then instrumentalise what is made? You know, it's the thing about, you know, Colin Deland as a model is that, and the problem that a little problem I have with Rena Spallings is that Rena Spallings is almost like a textbook version of Colin Deland. And the good thing about Colin Deland was that he didn't really know what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And this idea of amateurness and the small, and somehow it leading to it being more exciting is, and flying by the, you know, seat of your pants sometimes is part of it. So we're in a kind of like, you know, I think there needs to be a new model written for someone to be able to try and do this, but then we shouldn't be living precariously the whole time either. So I don't know what the answer is there, but that's the question.
I mean, I can I ask a question?
Sorry, of course.
About that? I mean, that is something I ask myself relatively often, that question of how precarious should I be living? Should I be willing to live? What kind of risks should I be willing to take? And I have to answer honestly, I don't want to take risks because I would like to keep a roof over my head and keep feeding myself and clothing myself and taking some holidays. But on the other hand, I do know that when I look to these models, historical models, Colin Deland and other, you know, examples, they did live precariously, and that has been romanticized, which is a problem.
Yeah.
But it's also a truth. So I wonder whether you think people expect to have it too easy these days, whether they want their funding because they deserve it, so to speak. Is there a problem with that?
I've no idea, really, in some respects, the answer to the question. But I think that the situation is, you know, times are the exciting thing, and the positive thing is that times are always changing, they're always different. And I think we're at a moment, especially in London, where it's ripe for something experimental to happen. The only thing is, how would you fund it? You'd need somebody to come in, start a small commercial gallery. I mean, one thing, you know, that would take risks. And I think one of the things that's happened with the contemporary art market in the country, which is London, basically, let's face it, is that there's a lot of galleries that have closed. So the ones that are left are anxious. They're not taking very many risks. They've been doing it for a long time, so they're just going through the motions, you could say, to overgeneralise slightly. And then you've got the larger galleries, which are pure business, and there's no passion left there. So I think that, you know, we need someone creative to come in. It could be an artist to come and represent a community of artists. And there are a lot of artists who are unrepresented now as well, who've either lost their galleries who aren't going with the galleries that are still there because they don't see anything in common with them. So I think the question is, you know, is who is going to change this and who is going to provide something exciting and a model for us all to work with.
My phone is off. I think that was my phone.
You've
got the volume off on the side. Sorry, guys, we're getting diverted. I was at a discussion in Kingston University a little while ago, and it was, and this same idea of, well, where's the money going to come from came up with a discussion about the need for this. And there was a leaning idea of leaning on the large commercial galleries who, but I presume they meant things like Gagosian, but I just don't really see it happening. I mean, in the future, I can't imagine that they can be persuaded to understand. But just for instance, excuse me for being, I just came to my mind as a flash, Paul Noble, right, with Gagosian Gallery, used to run City Racing with me. Now, he could tell them, couldn't he? Because he knows what it was like to run City Racing, which was an artist-run space that we tried not to romanticise in a book. Yeah. But by showing how little money we used to spend and how unglamorous it was. But, I mean, that's the only way that if somebody... I can't really see how they... Why would they bother? They're just capitalists. They don't care.
Yeah.
I think today the analogy is different. I mean, the economy is different. So, you know, those days, New York was poor. And that led to a flourishing art scene, and they had to stick together in order to make it, make whatever it was that they were making. And as you said, it was much less professional, in inverted commas. I think there are spaces, commercial galleries, that are doing something differently. Arcadium is one of them. Rodeo Gallery is one of them.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
On the other hand, I think the economy doesn't really help them because they have to sustain themselves by doing art fairs. And then, of course, that dilutes the program because they have to have a commercial show in the middle of the program just because they need to pay the rent.
But often they don't make money at art fairs either. They just break
that's
even.
That's it.
They don't even make any money.
Or they do it for visibility.
Exactly. So, it's a form of publicity. Yeah. It balances
so off. I think that's why it's a difficult moment as opposed to when you're talking about in New York in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So, I mean, the idea is, like, what do? Do you not do art fairs? Small galleries don't make money unless they go to art fairs. But, you know, is there a way of just doing two or three shows a year, keeping your overheads down, working with artists in a different way? I mean, it's got to be an effective business, but it's also, is there a way of connecting that with a way of being itinerant in some way? You know, do you have to have a premises? Could you just have a publishing imprint and do off-site projects? I don't know.
I think there are people doing this. There are. It's just they're not very visible because they're so small.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, villages are not always visible to other villages. I mean, you know, London probably has many things going on that, well, certainly does have that I don't know about.
I think small is good.
Yes,
I
no,
think,
in principle.
No, I think in reality, small is good. I think
it may be the only way it can work.
I think, you know, there's room for big and small on the map, right? But I think this kind of naturalized ambition to conquer the world with your art, I just think that doesn't work for most people. Why would you want that? I mean, you know, what matters is community. What matters is sort of exploring ideas and working with materials and sort of experimenting.
But then again, artists have to make a living out of the work.
Well, that's the problem.
I would argue against that because I think you don't have to make a living out of your work. I have never made
You have to make
work.
A living, not
yeah, you have to make a living, but not out of your work. Yeah. I think this is a misconception which has been pushed, and this idea of ruling the world with your art, this has been pushed, and it's crazy.
There's no natural equivalence between art and money. It's an artificial one.
They're antithetical to each other.
But then
really.
you join a gallery because you want some sales and you want visibility of your work. You want the gallery to create opportunities for you. So it's like a platform for
at its idealist.
Yeah.
Idealist,
so
yeah.
if you're with a small gallery and you don't have bricks and mortar kind of then you are cut out of, you're excluded from art fairs. So again, it's a vicious circle.
However, the other model involved something like along the lines of, like, rather than, obviously, everything can be bought and sold and art is a commodity, but if you were to concentrate on the purely aesthetic, i.e. metapolitical side of it, rather than the kind of market, and had a model for an organisation based on critical concerns and just social and economic and political ideas through the art itself.
Which could be local or worldwide too. It can be both.
They can, you know,
within the same
franchise. I mean, who knows?
If that was the main concern.
No, if that was the overlying reason.
Yeah, and you were still somehow able to operate and keep going, then, you know, that would be one of the ways that you could set up a situation, and hopefully there'd be a way that artists could be... That's the way that you would represent the artist ideally. You know, that would kind of be a utopian ideological position, but, you know, it might be a way of doing it, you know.
But how do you divorce... art and from money when every graduate from art school needs to price their work for their degree show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they're taught, this is teaching. Yeah. You're talking about what they're taught to do.
And what they're in fact required to do in order to complete their degree show.
Yes, I agree. It's contradictory.
So we're thinking of a whole perhaps rethink of what...
But this is maybe why some art schools are changing and some of there are alternative art schools because there is an alternative attitude taken towards this kind of thing. I mean, the academisation of art is one thing, and then the commercialisation of it too, and then there is a kickback perhaps to this. Listen, Ellen, do you want to talk about any of the spaces involved in the show, which was at Beaux-Arts in Brussels that you wrote about? Because I mean, if you describe some of them, maybe they'll expand the discussion a bit.
It was nice when I read Andrew's piece. There was a kind of resonance between what he was talking about and what I felt this show had in some ways achieved, because it felt a bit like a bazaar. You know, it was like you were walking through and there was one room after another, like I said, about 15 different galleries.
What's bazaar? Tell us what that is, first of all.
Okay, Beaux-Arts is the new coinage of the name for Beaux-Arts, which is the kind of Palais des Beaux-Arts in Brussels.
Gotcha.
Which is...
So is it a play on words? Is
that it's a sort of neologism, phoneticism. And... The Palais des Beaux-Arts is the temporary exhibition venue, as opposed to the Museum of Beaux-Arts, which is the permanent museum. So Beaux-Arts hosts concerts and dance and...
It's an art center.
It's an art center, and it has many, many exhibitions, and their exhibitions tend to be extremely large. So 15 galleries, 15 large rooms, one after another, each with a different thing in it. So in this case, the exhibition is called Somewhere in Between Contemporary Scenes in Europe, and they had invited a number of different artist-run spaces from Brussels, but also curators from around Europe, and then it also included a presentation from the art school in Ghent, curatorial course, as well as a library of artist-made publications, and a whole other curated exhibition about at the avant-garde in Eastern Europe. So it was vast, and walking through it actually felt like biennials of like 15 years ago, really. It was like a kind of collection of interesting things going on and lots of different ways of working, different sort of levels of presentation in terms of the finishing, experimental ideas.
But not a mess, a variety.
A big variety. It was not an intended pun when I said bazaar, but I was thinking of kind of a big market, you know, where you were walking through and you were encountering all kinds of different presentations. So, but actually, the three spaces that are based in Brussels, so Établissement d'en Face, which is an artist-run space that has had dozens of different artists associated with it on its board, and it changes every few years, has been going since 1991, and they've moved around Brussels to lots of different venues, or not lots, but several different places, and now they're right across the street from the Beaux-Arts. So they were invited into the space, which was designed by Victor Horta and opened in 1928. It's Art Nouveau at its finest. It's an enormous space. I mean, the concert hall is shaped like the inside of a violin. It's absolutely beautiful. So it's quite a formal space, and they were invited in to curate a show in their house style. So they could do what they wanted. La Loge, which is another space in Brussels, in a former Masonic lodge, where the program is anchored around architecture and theory quite a lot, as well as contemporary art. And then the third space, or in fact, is an itinerant collective called Complot, which is a curatorial collective rather than a space in itself. So each of those was invited to curate a show within this bigger show. And I thought that they did it in a very diverse way. So Établissement d'en Face did a solo show, and they invited a Norwegian artist called Steinar Haga Christensen, who presented a collection called from his Brown period. So he kind of invented this.
It's a fake period.
It's a fake period based on the avant-garde tendency.
He never had a red period or a blue period.
Not yet, anyway. But yeah, it's sort of a joke on Picasso's blue period or whatever you what will you. In fact, Établissement d'en Face had a three-person show, but each one of them had their own room.
So it felt like solo
shows.
Some of these places may never have had so much room to work with before,
which is
quite interesting. So I was going to ask you what the space opposite the bazaar was like, so they came out of.
Yeah, that's an old shop, a former shop.
So very small.
But also built around the same time and sort of a glass frontage. So, probably 20 meters by 10. So not tiny. Not tiny artist-run spaces.
It's still
in
quite
London,
a leap of the imagination to then do three.
So these spaces, the exhibition was street level.
In the bazaar, no, you had to go in, you had to purchase a ticket, and then it was within.
A conscious choice.
And there were a couple of other big shows. So there was a big show of protest, as so many institutions across the world or Western world are doing May 68, as you mentioned, Andrew.
Because I got the sense that it's separate from a museum.
It's within, when you walk through it, you sort of felt like you were somewhere else because of this kind of... you were being transported into the vibe, for want of a better word, of whatever that artist-run space was. So when you got to the Complot one, it was much more chaotic. It was a group show with, I think they'd invited 23 different curators to do this show, who they'd worked with over the years. So they kind of brought everyone back together, and each of those curators could invite some artists. It was this kind of chain invitation style exhibition. And within that exhibition by Complot, there were a lot of new collaborations, so artists who hadn't worked together working together, and sculptural pieces taking on the sort of architecture of the building, and then other works sitting on top of that. So it was really layered and really dynamic. And then when you went through to the actually largest room in the whole run of rooms, that was the space that they had given over to the students. So I thought that was quite an interesting decision and quite radical, I think, in a way. This is a place,
they're charging money.
They're charging money. It's the capital. It's the largest space, and they've given it to students from CASC school in Ghent.
Now, somebody said earlier on, before we came on, something about how that in Brussels, they don't really have a big... museum statement.
That's right. Yeah.
Architecturally speaking, they have this art center, but there's no, like many cities would normally
not a new one
for big
So they have Wheels, which is in an old brewery, which I think performs that
role,
sort of role within Brussels. So Wheels is, I think, an extremely good institution where solo and group shows of contemporary artists are put on in a kind of Kunsthalle way, so like really well-researched and consolidated exhibitions.
But it's not a
Starkitecture kind
that's,
of
that's
signature
what, that's
building.
That's what I meant. That's what we were talking
it's
about.
Flagship building.
As far as I know, the Centre Pompidou is going to open a branch in Brussels, right? So...
Yeah, I mean, these things are always changing, of course, but it was quite interesting that it was the capital of Europe, as it were, but it doesn't have...
The interesting thing about it is that the centre of Brussels doesn't have that kind of iconic Starkitecture project, which is like a cultural signifier for being a global player in the contemporary art world as a kind of collecting institution. And it's interesting that you mention Wheels, because I guess Bozar does temporary exhibitions, but it's got no collection, whereas Wheels is a Kunsthalle in the same model. And they did an excellent exhibition last year in 2017 called The Absent Museum, which asked what would be the best form of constructing a new museum in Brussels, which is the centre of the European project with EU and NATO nearby, You know, and when all museums are trying to diversify their collections and make the ultimate collection, which is absolutely impossible. You know, how would you go about making that infinite collection to include everybody? So this was a discussion that Dirk Snauvert, the director of Wills, was talking about in that exhibition, which was really interesting. And people like Charles Escher and others wrote for the catalogue. And Boris Groys has talked about this idea of kind of collections as well. But I think what is interesting with regard to the show that you've written about, Ellen, is the fact that it's a temporary project, and it's a big institution, but also it is just a series of temporary small projects in the centre of what is becoming a fragmented Europe. So I don't know if you what you thought about that. Did it kind of successfully, curatorially examine this idea of multiple identities?
Yes and no. I mean, it was a very frustrating exhibition to visit because of the because of its mission statement. So it said it was going to explore the contemporary art scene across Brussels, across Europe,
which is rather large,
and which is really large.
Big
and
ambition.
And you know, and it turned out, as I did more research, that it was funded by a kind of initiative called Trauma and Revival, which wanted to look at post, you know, post-separation of Europe, you know, East and West relations and so on. So, I mean, it set itself an impossible task, and it didn't meet that task, funnily enough. But I think, you know, that these crazy ideas have to be tried, and I think that's how we get somewhere. So, I mean, the biggest frustration for me was the fact that this exhibition called Orient was subsumed. It was curated by Michal Novotný from Futura Art Center in Prague, and that was really an exhibition in itself. You know, that it had 40 artists in it, covering 50 years of art making. So many avant-garde pieces, so many really fantastic works that had echoes of, you know, YBA works, but they'd been made 10 years previously. So just really exciting stuff.
And that was part of the Somewhere in Between.
It was part
show.
Of Somewhere in Between. So
did
so
it have enough space, do you think, Ellen?
No. In a word, no. It was crammed in around the corner and then in the basement.
Yeah.
It was just not right for me. So you had but what I did admire was this kind of umbrella where you had long-standing artist-run spaces that have survived in Brussels over decades, students, and a really, really museum-class exhibition crammed into the same space. But on the other hand, you know, I would have spread it out. I would have given Orient its own kind of suite of rooms within the museum and so on. But I just want to go back to the Absent Museum because I also thought it was a brilliant show. And what I, from my take on it, in terms of this idea of forming a collection for Belgium, is that, you know, Belgium has all these problems that it's not unified. So, I mean, I did a little bit of work over the years with a contemporary art heritage Flanders, who invited me over to visit things and so on. And they were an organization who were trying to bring together the four major collecting institutions within Flanders of collecting contemporary art, that is. And that was really difficult for political reasons. And I'm just talking about Flanders there. There's also Wallonia.
Yeah.
There's also the Brussels region, which is separate. There's three linguistic regions, and there's a federal region. There's a federal government. So Belgium is this kind
That's just one country in Europe.
And it's a tiny one. You know? But, I mean, on the other... So you have this kind of political challenge or geopolitical challenge on a tiny map, square of the map. But what you do have in Belgium is this really long-standing culture of collecting. So artists can rely on some sort of support from collectors who don't just buy one work. They kind of...
patronize.
Yeah, they patronize.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think, yeah, it's an interesting place.
Can I just ask a question, which I'm not even sure if it's what it is exactly, but basically it interests me that an institution... which I know we've just said the bazaar is good, really, but it's an art centre. But it has absorbed, for this show, all these smaller things. So you have a big thing which absorbs the small things and gets the kind of cred, as it were. This is cynical, OK? Cred of all those small, which we would say, you know, good organisations, it absorbs it. And I mean, I've been in a show, it's something a bit similar has happened where, you know, and I, it's a difficult one because you kind of think, well, okay, and then we all leave. And then it's all like it was before. Is it, or has it changed anything? And part of me was thinking, like, maybe money should go into transport systems and then we could all get to these damn different places all over the place more easily, or we would know about them. But okay, it does give attention. Do you think it does? That's the cynical case.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying and I understand it. I would say that you sound like a Londoner when you say that, and that Brussels is really small.
Yeah.
So it you kind of, you know, the scene is smaller.
So to find them actually is not hard.
To find them is not hard. To know them is not difficult.
Yeah.
To go there repeatedly.
Because in London it's very relaxed. Not easy, is it?
It's not easy in London.
It really
it's
isn't.
It's stressful. It's expensive to get around town. Mm-hmm. It's crowded, et cetera, et cetera. So I think... there's something to be
but
said.
That difference helps.
I do believe so. Yeah.
It's more of a coming together than a kind of we're going to give you a gift for a little bit and then take it away again.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
I mean, okay, but I do take your point that, you know, great, you sat on the mothership for 5 minutes and then what, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it does sound like the show that you said was not given enough space, that was curated show, really is one that should, and maybe it is going to, will go somewhere else.
It will. It's actually...
Because it sounds like it deserves to.
It's going to Bunkier Stücki in Krakow.
So if that's been recognised, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it's a touring show.
Things do come out of
it. If you go to Krakow, I would recommend going to see it.
So maybe that's why they had space from Eastern Europe, because it's supposed to bridge that... But then again, that makes sense why... I mean, what you were saying about transport and having everything in one place, it makes sense why artists leave London to... and move to Brussels or to Berlin to Athens.
Yeah, I love going to Europe myself. I mean, I can't tell you how angry I am about Brexit because I'm worried I'm going to have to get a damn visa if I want to cross over the Channel or something, which I do quite often. It'd be terrible. Did you want to say something, Andrew? Sorry.
No, I was just nodding.
Just looking friendly. Okay, now listen, let's just take what time we have left for the programme, which is a fair bit, to ask Vasilios to talk a bit about what you wrote about, which was... we called it an Athens Roundup, which basically just means somebody goes to a city or a country, whatever it may be. In this case, it's Athens, obviously. And you review your choice of some exhibitions that are going on all at one time.
Yeah. For me, the interesting thing was that I wanted to see what's happening after Documenta. So it's been a year after Documenta...
Was in Athens,
yes.
As well as being in...
Yes, in Kassel.
Kassel.
I really wanted to see what the impact of that would be in very different spaces. So I chose to write about a commercial gallery that was opening a branch in Piraeus at the port. That's Rodeo Gallery, who's a London gallery. And the owner decided to capitalize on this energy. So not so much thinking of the market, but of the interest that Athens is receiving lately post-Documenta from curators and from artists, because it's so cheap to move to Athens. So you can use it as a base. And in fact, this is what a lot of artists are doing these days. They use it as a base or they buy a studio and they can move around. Flying is a lot cheaper now. You can use budget airlines, and you can produce the work the way you want it without having any media distractions in an environment which is friendly to the artist. So I suppose Documenta, when they said learning from Athens, I think whatever I think about the exhibition per se, the interesting thing was that artists learned about Athens. What is it like to be in Athens, basically, those who visit it. And there's an interesting anarchic sort of New York in the 80s, Colin Deland situation, because there's no market, essentially. There are very big collectors, but not a regulated market, not an infrastructure that would support the market. The museum situation is very weak. So there are big museums, but the program is it's not strategic. So it hasn't been strategically planned. Also, unlike London, where there's partnerships and business matching between the culturepreneurs and the entrepreneurs. There's no such thing there. So it's your shot, basically. So if you want to do it, go for it. So there's that attitude. You do it. You find the funds. You ask your friends. You do an open studio. You invite the collectors. So it's like early days of the art world, in a way. And it's refreshing for a lot of people. So a lot of people, curators and artists, and in fact, the whole Documenta troupe of curators, they've kept their apartments and they go back, is refreshing and exciting in this climate. So,
certainly in relation to if you go to pre the Documenta, coming there,
pre Documenta,
we were talking about a very difficult financial time.
Still is.
Yes, I know. That's what they were deep in.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah.
And so then this Documenta came. I mean, it's a bit like someone saying, here's a funfair, come to your prison,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
That's and extreme,
people,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah. No, a lot of people visited and they saw what it's like. They experienced it. And I think it was the best time to be in Greece because the spring is really, really nice and you'd sort of romanticise things as well. and then people thought, very pragmatically, okay, we can do something here.
Yeah. But the people who are there already, how do they fit into this? Because you're talking about people who've gone there.
The people who are there, you talk about the Greek artists.
I presume there are some.
So they are trying to figure out a way to be visible and also to negotiate the past with the present and with the present moment. So that's kind of hard for them.
But is that one of the shows that you reviewed?
Yes.
Which one would that be?
That was the show at the Miet. It's interesting to... I mean, this is a space which is belongs to the National Bank of Greece. The National Bank of Greece was public.
Yeah.
So it started in 1840 after big historical things. And then it became private. But part of its mission, while it was public, it was to educate Greek people that couldn't travel, couldn't see shows. So it was a locus of culture. They would do readings, poetry, you know, exhibitions, that sort of thing. And the interesting thing with that space is that they have a publication strand, so they publish their own, and they're very highbrow books. On different subjects, from sociology to critical theory to exhibitions to poetry. The director of the space is a poet himself. So he's not a museum administrator. He doesn't come from a museological background.
He didn't just take up poetry after a bit.
And they operate three spaces in Athens. They do nights where they invite people that are not the stars of the scene. So people that are slightly more obscure, they get a chance to show the work. I have to admit that the logic of the program sometimes doesn't really make sense, but I suppose that's the excitement.
Well, that's what experimentation, that's what it does.
Yeah.
You know, you do get failures in experimentation, don't you?
That's why it's all a successful attitude.
Yeah.
That's why I related to what Andrew was saying about calling to land moment. Because
well, I guess,
there's
that. Yeah. There's that whole idea of just forming some kind of energy.
Yeah.
Mm. And it doesn't really matter what the kind of outcome is, as long as there's some kind of passion and energy, and it feels like everyone is creating something new, new knowledge, new kind of, I don't know, just something socially new more than mm-hmm. anything else as well, which relates to the exhibition that you were reviewing for the magazine as well in Brussels, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that this is kind of something that runs through all three articles.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's interesting in terms of Greece, because mm-hmm. you are kind of sketching out a situation where there is potential for...
There's a lot of potential, I think.
Yeah.
And the three spaces that I review are very different spaces. So you get a commercial gallery that doesn't have the most commercial program, and yet it appeals to collectors and curators that decides to open a space in Greece, in Athens, in Greece. Then it's an old space which is something between a Kunsthalle with a commercial streak to it. So it's been around for 30 years. It started by a woman who was very ambitious and wanted to have, again, a multidisciplinary program, but now focuses on younger artists. And then the space of the bank, which is a proper museum space, quite amazing building, a landmark building. And they also have three different spaces. And this exhibition, this particular exhibition,
What's that one called?
The artist is called Nikos Papadopoulos.
No, sorry, the space.
Miet.
So that's Miet. And the other one was called Ileana Tunta Contemporary Art Center. Sorry, that's the one we haven't said.
So that particular exhibition by Nikos Papadopoulos, I thought it was, which actually it runs through the end of September. It was really interesting because it was putting together in a sort of very personal way all the issues that Greek artists, because that's what you asked me, are worried about. So on one hand, you have to deal with the past. On the other hand, you want to be visible. And then you have to do something different, which is something personal. You have to have an input, not, you know, get a magazine and do what other people are doing. And he did that. And I felt the way the exhibition was conceived, it was really, really interesting. Because they got a loan from, I mean, if you read the article, you see that it's about the life of plants, and through that he talks about migration, he talks about hybridity, he talks about shaping of identities, he talks about all these social issues, but through botanical research.
As a metaphor,
I thought that was really interesting. And then he comes in with his dog and his concerns and his quest for a private Eden, and then he lost his father while he was doing the show, so there's a lot of empathy as well in that exhibition. But the way it's been curated and the way it's been sort of put together, it's really interesting. And now they're doing a walk in the area as well. So which again connects the two spaces, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about the artist community in Athens at the moment, and whether you're able to recognize or see any evidence of people wanting to stay in Athens rather than wanting to go abroad, or I'm just wondering what the desire is there at the moment, and is the scene there exciting enough for people to want to stay and make it even better, or is there still has there been a desire to go, say, to London or New York or wherever?
Are you talking about the Greek artists?
Greek artists.
Yeah, okay. Greek artists, I think they want to stay because they see that there's a bigger dialogue. So the reason why they moved was because they wanted to have that sort of dialogue, which they couldn't have in their own country because there were, limited spaces where they could show the work. And then it was also much more conservative, how you get to show somewhere through introduction, or you have to be someone's student in order to get accommodation, you know, that sort of thing. But now everything is much more
accessible. Maybe.
Yeah, it's more like a trial and error. So, okay, you do this, it doesn't work, but so what?
So you try
something
else.
Yeah. So there's that element there. That's why I think it's quite exciting, and it's not professional in the London sense of the word.
But it's interesting that it's also a place where you can just go and relax, which might sound unimportant. But, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, Documenta curators have still got apartments there.
Yeah.
I mean, just on an anecdotal level, Callie Spooner and her partner Jesper Liss Thompson live there.
Yeah, I know.
And one of the things that Callie said to me was that she enjoys being there because she can save all of her meetings for when she comes back to London in a week and just get on with making her work in Athens.
Well, that's what I mean. You don't have the distractions. And especially if you're not Greek, you're not involved in, you don't really know a lot of things. You don't pick up the
street politics.
So you don't really care. You focus on your work. There's a lot of writers
Also interesting about that is that if you've got Rodeo Gallery and a number of international artists moving to Athens, hopefully that will help and enrich the scene for local artists there in terms of just the kind of connections. And, you know, is there a potential there, do you think, for it to for that to amplify what's going on in
I think
in,
so.
On a local
I mean, I, what I felt was interesting about Rodeo was that they opened with, and I'm using this word, unmonumental show. So normally you want someone to open a space.
A big hitter.
Yeah, straight after Basel, and they have a grand opening. Or they have a group show of their artists. That's the kind of thing you do. And yet she showed an artist whose work is very much about fluidity. And I think that really represents, apart from reversing expectations, it really represents the scene. So she got that. Mm. And I thought that was a really, really interesting thing. Going back to your question, I think Athens has a lot of collectors, but they don't necessarily buy Greek art or they don't necessarily buy from Greek galleries. They do have private foundations and they do interesting projects. I wasn't really interested in highlighting those because I think that's a different thing altogether. So I wanted this to be a platform for...
But it's more historical, that, isn't it? I mean, that's been going on for quite a long time.
For quite a long time,
this is what you've put on is new happening in Athens.
So you had spaces like... Gagosian has a space in Athens because he wants to tap into that. But when Rodeo opens, it's not because she wants to tap into the collectors. She can do that from London, and I think she's not really after the sort of market. She's doing a lot of...
Do you think she might pick up on Greek artists? And
She already represents Greek artists.
She does,
yeah.
And so they will come to show her gallery here, maybe?
They do. But I think what she wants is she wants to capitalize on this vibe, because we talked about it. And I said, well, why did you go to Piraeus? Because that's kind of far out from where the other galleries are.
You mean where she's placed herself?
Yes. Right. And I said, won't you feel lonely? And she said, well, actually, I think this is a very interesting area because it's the port. And this is where, this idea of transformation. Mm. But also there's a lot of histories in that area because it used to be... it's the place where you go to the islands, to move away from Athens, to have a holiday. So again, going to the good life or the easy living, if you want. On the other hand, it was a business commerce, and it is a hub, commercial hub. And now it's been bought by the Chinese. So again...
Anything could happen then.
So again, you get that diversity and that sort of multicultural element, which is, to me, it's really exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it was a very wise decision, really.
And you're talking about Athens, so mostly you're not saying that people might move to Greece. You are specifically talking about, just to be clear about it,
yes,
for people, because it's interesting.
There are two main cities. There are two main cities. So there's up north is Thessaloniki, which is a difficult one, because there is infrastructure, but the people seem to have given up. So artists not so much among their concerns. They don't want to challenge
Are they generally an older looking people?
It's an older model.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
They expect a lot of things from the galleries, or they expect things to come to them. So they're not active in seeking out opportunities. There is a biennial which is quite good in Thessaloniki, and there are some extremely good historical museums. Like the archaeological museum is amazing there. There's because of their relationship with Turkey. There's some, so it's quite interesting if you're doing research. But as far as the vibe, because that's what we're talking about here, there isn't any. So I'm sorry to say, but
it's interesting with Rodeo because they were in Istanbul before with different spaces and different slightly different areas of town, and then London in Charing Cross Road,
their reputation grew from Istanbul.
Yeah, so this move to Athens is in a sequence of moves to interesting, slightly edgy place. Edgy. That's such a meaningless word, but interesting.
Well,
places.
It is edgy actually. Right now, I would say Athens is quite edgy compared to the rest of Europe. Mm.
Do you think that the poverty, the economic state of Greece is like... I mean, I remember back in the 90s in London when we were in a recessionary period, late 80s, 90s, and actually there was lots of property available because of this.
Yeah.
You could squat, you could everything came
it's,
up. There was
it's
far
exactly
more
like those days where the artists
physical
would,
stuff was available.
Would use office space to turn it into
and that's what, probably true.
Living space. That's that's true.
In Athens now, is you that squat, more like that now?
Yeah. You can squat. It's very cheap to rent.
A bit like New York would have had all the lofts in the. Yeah, I mean, well, I'm going a long way back.
Well, also, excuse me. You know, also the kind of way that artists in the last 20 years have moved to Berlin, and then even Brussels was kind of an option because it was relatively inexpensive to live, only a couple of hours from London. But I guess Athens is kind of the new European centre, perhaps, or it could be. You know, in a few years' time,
there's certainly potential. So again, it's. I think the interesting thing is that. Because the money has, because the state has no money, there's no intervention. So it really comes down to what the community does. So it's their shot.
Which is great. I think we're going to end the programme now. But I've really enjoyed listening to you all and having a little bit of my own words in occasionally, which is good. I'm now going to do your names so everyone knows who we've been listening to. We've been listening to Andrew Hunt, Ellen Mara de Wachter and Vasilios Dupas. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Good night, listener. And hope you'll be listening to this on podcast again because it was so great, and telling all your friends and subscribing. Don't forget to our great offer to Art Monthly where you get a free back catalogue. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.